kingdom should work. Now, I was actually going to wait just a tiny bit, but that's okay. In honor of our King, I would like us all to stand and let's pray the Lord's Prayer. Okay, let's pray. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen. You may be seated. How many of you come from a family that has a tradition or has had a tradition of saying that prayer regularly? I'm just curious. I do, and we do. I love that prayer, and I love the idea of Christians saying it and endeavoring to explore its reality the world over. All right. Caesar Augustus. The genius of Caesar Augustus came in the fact that he did not overplay his hand. So let's go back to one of our lessons that we learned about bringing the lessons from Rome into the empire, into the classroom. And that is, when you have authority, there is a danger in what? Abusing it. Overextending authority tends to lose more than what you gain. It reminds me a little bit of Aaron's story about when you run away, you find bigger problems than what you ran away from. There are so many illustrations of that. And the Romans were actually very good at finding that balance and maintaining power. Ruthlessly so, but at the same time, no one to back up. In fact, in the days of the Medicis in Florence, a very, very influential writer wrote a book on basically how to get and preserve power with no moral constraints whatsoever. Although it doesn't mean don't be moral, because sometimes if you're moral, you actually keep the power better. So, you know, don't lose track of that. Who knows the man I'm talking about? That's right. Yes, the Prince is the title. There are several. He wrote many books, but that's the well-known one in Machiavelli. It's a fascinating study of politics and how power works. And he based his concepts almost completely on his study of Rome. And I've talked to people already. It was like Rome. Machiavelli. That's not really applicable anymore. No, Machiavelli is very applicable to our current situation and so on how to get power and maintain it. There's so many balancing acts in there, and he follows that. Okay, don't overextend authority. The other one was use history to teach or help shape
moral
imagination. The concept that love your neighbor as yourself. Well, you know us, we can find an excuse. Who is my neighbor? We ask that too. All right. We're now going to go hit history here a little bit. The age of empire, the age of emperors, Augustus, several things came together to make him extremely influential. And one of them was his age. He kept thinking of successors and then they would die before him. But one thing that happened is that it created a time of more or less stability. Remember, he was not considered a king. They shunned that name. He was rather the first patron of families. And what they had, I told you about that pyramid scheme and how you have several massive families. And they would balance each other by sharing power. And so they had the rule that the consuls, who were the head people, could not be elected for another year. They would serve in years. So the families would know it. They're going to come and go, and then they'll come back again, and they'll go and they'll scheme for how to make it work when they're in power. And so these several families would juggle, kind of, and sort of stay balancing on top of this ball as it rolled along. That got misplaced because finally they became so powerful, and this especially was three of them. The first triumvirate, and we did get the name wrong. It wasn't Lepidus. So the first triumvirate was Julius Caesar and Pompey the Great and Crassus. Crassus was a a little bit of a new guy, and he's the one who boasted the fact that you're not really rich unless you can buy an army. All right? And armies cost a lot of money back then. The second triumvirate, then, after that first one crumbled, was Octavian or Augustus, Antony, and Lepidus. And they're definitely in Julius Caesar. It's a good story. What was I going to say? So he was the top patron. There's now one patron for the whole empire. And this patron was the imperator. That means commander of the army. And the armies, by this time, were not swearing allegiance to an institution, not to the Romans. They were to the Roman name because the imperators were representing the Rome, but they would swear to their commander. And this would be renewed every year. I'm curious, do you know the Latin word for the swearing of an oath of allegiance? It's one that has entered Christian vocabulary. All right, so I'm just curious if you knew. It's okay if you didn't. Sacramentum, sacrament. Thus, sacramentum was the oath of allegiance that a soldier would need to swear every year to his lord, more or less. And the word lord was used. Okay, so he got that going. He was the first patron. He was the head of the army, and that kind of helped resolve all this terrible tension that was tearing the country apart with all these civil wars, and things sort of settled down. He then would appoint a successor. The Senate would ratify it, and then it would move on. So that was a problem, one of succession, how to move on. There were elections in Rome. That's how magistrates were elected, consuls were elected, but it depended on what you were, not some things you didn't actually vote on, and this successor was one of them. Incidentally, the elections were not one man, one vote. They were divided into centuries, that is, different groups, neighborhoods, by numbering those early days. They would decide by lot which century got to come first. Then they would vote among themselves, and whoever they voted for, that was their vote. All right, and often the following centuries would follow the lead of the first one, and so whoever yelled the loudest, they kind of got it. That happens quite a number of times. Again, that is the system behind the electoral college system in the U.S. That's where they got the idea. Okay, he started this. They had a series of emperors. Of course, there was dear old Tiberius, who was a dour individual, but a good enough administrator. And then what happened then, these people started to get, the power would go to their head. Who knows who came up with the phrase, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Have you heard that? Do you know who says it? Who said it? Lord Acton, Catholic political thinker, theologian who studied history. And again, that comes from, I think, a study of this age. Power corrupts, power tends to corrupt, or power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And it's hard to argue with it as you look at these things. So in the Bible, we read, "Be not many teachers." It has a little bit of that same concept. Don't get too strong with that. Don't be too whatever. So after Tiberius comes Caligula. Caligula was the terrible name of Roman history. And Veronica came home the other evening a while ago and said, "Did you know that there was an emperor that made his horse a senator?" Caligula had a disease, an accident, and something happened to his mind, and he went insane, and it was a bad deal. He was killed then by the army. So what? And by leading men of Rome, and his uncle Claudius was put on. There are many deep stories, and we cannot go into the stories of the individual emperors. Study them. There are some of them given in this timeline. They're very interesting. After Caligula, Claudius, and after Claudius, Caesar. The lines are all tangled and twisted with these family lines, and it was really, really messy. You've all heard of did I say Caesar? I meant Nero. You've all heard of Nero, right? Nero, again, started out fairly good and fairly quickly became the really bad name. I tried to look up this number, And I didn't find it briefly in Wikipedia or wherever it was, but I heard it recently. The largest number, the largest actual number in the ancient record is either 4 billion denarii or something like that, or 40 billion denarii. That is the biggest number mentioned in any ancient source. And it is how much the Roman government was in debt after his death. he spent money. And again, the army killed him. So this thing of being the head of the army, what's happening now is instead of the Senate deciding who is going to rule, or a clash of different armies deciding who's going to rule, the army itself will come up and decide. After Nero goes, I think was the time, the year of the four emperors, and what happened is one man's, well, the army decides, well, then let's buy the office, you know. So they actually had an auction. The highest bidder got to be, that was dear Vitellius, I think, and then they killed him, and another guy came along. One Otho was in that mix somewhere. I might even have this written down. Galba Vitellius Otho Vespasian. Otho was actually a very wicked man, too. He was ugly. And by when I say he was ugly, I mean some of the stuff he did. And we're talking about what he would get for Caligula in his very depraved things that they would do. In ways that we think we're living in a bad time here, but this kind of public moral depravity that went on with some of these emperors was shockingly, disgustingly mind-blowing. That type of thing. And Otho was the one who would procure maybe other men's wives or their children or something like that for this man. Otho then killed himself because Vespasian was coming with his army and he did not want to bring Rome into civil war again. It was what some historians have said, the only noble act he's recorded to have ever done. And they don't mean that in the sense that he killed himself, great, the world is rid of him. They mean it in the fact that he honored the stability of Rome more than his own life, which in that sense, suicide was was a very honorable thing in a Roman perspective. Okay, Vespasian. Vespasian is famous because he's the one who led the troops into Judea with the war against the Jews. Now, I should say something about this. There is an act that Augustus is very famous for initiating a time period. I'm wondering if you're knowing what I'm thinking about. I'm guessing you do. Go ahead, Mr. Micah.
Pax Romana.
The Pax Romana, which means Roman peace. Okay? It's not actually a very well understood term, well understood time. So I hate to burst bubbles here. The Pax Romana was not actually a nice time of peace and prosperity and gentleness. There were less wars, but there were actually still a lot of wars. All right, especially on the borders. Rome was very much in the business now of I said they never. They prided themselves on never doing wars of expansion. Well, they were actually kind of starting now, but of course they tricked themselves into believing that they needed to protect their allies or get lead out of Romania, that type of thing. So that's where Trajan led.
It was rich.
Get the mines. Yes, there were both gold mines and lead mines, and so go into Dacia. And plus that old king Decebalus is kind of he's kind of protective. And so he needed to be removed.
Actually, in Ankara, did they build one of the most impressive pieces of architecture in the world?
Yes.
The bridge.
Yes, the bridge, which Hadrian, the next emperor, destroyed because he didn't want the barbarians coming back. But actually, people think that he was jealous of Trajan for doing it. When I was in Romania, that was quite an interesting thing to visit the town of Sarmizegetuza, The real Sarmizegetuza was the Dacian capital, but Sarmizegetuza was then relocated and made into a Roman camp, and it was quite accessible to visit. Now, when I first got there, I could hardly say Sarmizegetuza. Do you want to try it? Sarmizegetuza. It's one of those things that you wonder, how do you get that? Okay. Rome was growing and their armies were almost invincible, and this was largely again because they now had a real system where they were going out fighting other the barbarians, and the barbarians were anybody on the edge, okay, the people who weren't Romanized, fighting them, subduing them, and not fighting themselves. So it made them quite effective, and that is actually a good lesson. When Christians fight, they both lose, okay? We can learn that even as Mennonites. So, and in your students, definitely. In your schoolroom. Okay, what was I saying about that? So, the Pax Romana was not a time of peace, and in fact, we're not even sure if it really existed, if it was just a later thought put upon them, because Augustus boasted about the fact that he closed the doors to the temple of Janus, which the temple, that closing those doors indicated that the spirit of war was inside. The temple of Janus was the Roman divinity, and when the doors were open, the spirit of war had gone out. And when the doors were closed, it was inside. And so he had closed it. But what a lot of people don't get is that he closed them three times. In order to close them three times, you got to open them in between. And we're not sure if he left the doors open or if he left them closed when he died. And so this whole construct of the Pax Romana is a little bit of a funny thing. Also, there were several wars of rebellion during that time. But the one thing that it wasn't is there were not so many civil wars. And so that's where they think the concept of the Pax Romana was not that Rome was at peace, but they weren't fighting themselves, at least not as much. There were a few tense spots, relatively speaking. Okay, so we can't go over all the good emperors. I will point out a few influential times. If you look at your timeline, those of you who have one, there's 66 to 70, that was the first Jewish war. There were three Jewish wars. This is the most famous one and the most well-known one, and it was when the temple was destroyed. That is of tremendous historical interest to Christians because it split the Jews. The ones who had conspired with the Romans to have Jesus crucified, that whole faction was shut down, and it died with the temple. The Jewish religion was extremely land-oriented. I think I'm saying that right. Temple-centered, all right. Ritual-centered. When that temple quit working, it like took the soul out of their religion. Now the Pharisees had already put together a program of Torah-centeredness. Torah, where they base it on the scriptures and they have all these rituals that go with that. And their faction won. They were able to leave, and the Talmudic Jews are, we think, more or less an extension of what we read about in the Pharisees. But it was a huge shock to all Jews that their whole religion was like crushed. And so it didn't matter what you believed, something had changed. And it actually made either becoming a Christian or a Pharisee a little bit simpler, all right? Whatever you had believed before, it's not the same as it was then if you weren't a Christian. And incidentally, traditionally, the Christians escaped those terrible acts that were involved in the crushing of Jerusalem, and Jesus weeping over the city, saying, "I just wish you had followed the way of peace." It can bring tears to our eyes even today. All right, moving on from that. And by the way, I do have some other Christian kind of events over on the right-hand column. 211, the reign of Caracalla, then we have this law, the Constitutio Antoninia. That was a radical law. Remember how I said they kept granting citizenship to people as they would help them, and then they needed more armies, so then they kind of like extend the citizenship rights and so on like that. Meanwhile, and then they would go out and fight these wars, and it would bring immense booty back in, and then they would charge their enemies to pay them off, and they would. That's how the country funded itself. Economics was not a normal program back then. It was very important, but they didn't understand it, and maybe we do today, but at least more than what they did then. I'm not sure we completely do today either. So they, they would bring this money in. Well, then now when you're not conquering people anymore, the money's drying down and the expenses are going up. This is what we do. The government spends more and more, and then what? What's the answer?
Conquer war.
War, but there's another one.
Tax.
Taxes! It's time for taxes. So they didn't have, there were different taxes, and there were different times when taxes were very high. But one thing that was normal from the very beginning is there were death taxes, or what we might call inheritance taxes. And so the people are suspicious that Caracalla made this law that all people within the confines of the Roman Empire are now actually citizens, with the exception of slaves. They are citizens. Well, guess what? They all have to pay the tax. We don't know for sure if that's exactly or whatever. And again, he was not a very responsible ruler, I'm afraid. So, whatever. If you look at down through this list, one of the things you'll see is war with Parthia a couple of times. Parthia, what country today lives where is situated where Parthia was? If you were
between the two seas.
That's good.
The Sea of Caspian Sea and Black Sea. A little bit.
Not close. Parthia is essentially the same as Persia, which is the country of
Iran.
We have a Western history. And if you look back, and people from Iran and from the East, they have more of an Eastern right. And they have, for them, the Persian empires were just as great as the Roman Empire was. And it has had a durable influence over there. And so for them, the Romans are kind of these weird guys over from on the, you know, the side who kept invading Parthia. And then the Persians would invade back. And there were things that the world owes the Romans that it doesn't owe the Persians. So there was the Parthians, and then there were the Sassanids. But the Parthians were more or less the ruling family-like tribe name, and then the Sassanids were even a little bit more better, were better equipped and were stronger. But they really battled the Romans, and they both wore each other out. And then came the Muslims, and it collapsed. So that was the coming of Islam to Iran. Iran, incidentally, led the world. Rome is known for the fact that it had concrete, typically unreinforced concrete. Somewhere along the line, Iran became and is the world leader in concrete.
Cement.
Concrete. They make concrete that is 6 times stronger than normal American concrete. Interesting. How'd they get to do that?
Okay, and it's actually kind of a state secret how they managed to work all that out. Okay, let's keep going. The Caracalla, and then, so that was universal citizenship. It's about this time that a new group of peoples are starting to move, coming from the north and into the borders and fighting these brave, civilized Italians, okay, and Greeks and so on. They are the Goths, kind of the biggest tribe, but there are, in the end, 7 or 11 or 17 different tribes. They are what we would call the
Germans.
If you have Germanic background, you're barbarian guys. He's not.
I'm a Roman.
You're botching, bro.
No. Anyway, you won.
No. The Germanic tribes coming down into that created tremendous havoc. And they were fighters. They were tough. They were strong. They were not well organized. But they were fierce and strong, and of course later they were being pressured by other people behind them. So for example, you have the Vandals, who were so strong, and then they tore down these buildings or and took stuff and whatever, so they call whoever destroys nice things, that's a Vandal, okay? They actually were pretty civilized or respectful of what we call civilized compared
true,
to many others.
Is that true that three of them, that were totally erased from history, like the Heruli, the Vandals, and the Visigoths.
Not the Visigoths, the Heruli and the Vandals.
The Heruli and the third one, Ostrogoths.
Well, no, they kind of, the those lines merge, but the Goths pretty much stayed, there's a trackable history of them. For the VC, the Western and the Eastern Goths. But there is another, I've read long lists and some of them are completely gone. I come from the Alemanni. That was a Germanic tribe, and so I've studied that one. Do any of you know?
In Latin language, Alemannia is the name of
Yes. the tribe. Yes, so it was a big tribe. Do any of you know what Germanic tribe you might come from that are Germanic? No, they're not. There are many different ones.
They were the smartest
folks. For example, a lot of Germans come from the Saxon. The Saxon, then there were the Wends, the Angles, and those things. But I think a lot of Mennonites have Saxon background who are Germanic, at least. All right. Check it out. It's kind of interesting. Okay, we're going to shift gears now. Remember I said it shifted into the Dominate. And what happened is, in the Dominate... What happened there is that instead of pretending to just be the patron and being the leader of the army, like, for example, one of the things happened is every time a general would win, they would ask the Senate if they could hold a triumph. After Augustus, only the imperator was allowed to hold a triumph. So these other under-generals, they could win and all that, but the glory went to him, and he would hold the triumph. No other people holding a triumph in Rome. So in the dominant now, the time of the dominate, some of this pretense was lost and the emperor became a king. And that begins normally with Diocletian, who established the Tetrarchy. Now Diocletian was actually a very interesting man, and he's infamous among Christians because under him he started the Great Persecution when Christians were heavily persecuted. He is also the only emperor to, after a long reign, abdicated, stopped ruling, handed over power, went to go grow cabbages in his fortified palace in the Isle of Split, okay, or in the town of Split, and it's still there. Not the cabbages, but but the palace and the town. Yes. In Dalmatia is what it's called then. So you think these Dalmatian dogs, you know, that's where maybe that was coming to. Okay, we're going to have to kind of close with some of that. He was followed more or less by Constantine, and under Constantine, Christianity was legalized. Now, I want to talk about a number of things now. What was it like to be a normal person in the Roman Empire? We've already mentioned some of this. Most people were just working, trying to make a living and working within this complicated patronage system. Then there were slaves. They were just bought and sold, and I want to talk a little bit more about them because it's such a critical part of our understanding of the biblical world. Christians in the Roman Empire. Christians were not severely persecuted under Rome. Now that might burst another bubble. There were times of persecution. There were only two emperor-wide persecutions of any real note. One was in 250 under Decius, who died in Romania, and then the other one was under Diocletian and following some of the emperors following him. Christianity was not really persecuted. Christians were not really persecuted across the board, but they could be. That's the thing that gave it this unease. Now, timeline, and you go all the way back to the BC, somewhere in there it talks about the Bacchanalia. Whoops, I don't have my earlier one. And you might... now I'm really not finding it. 186. BC 186, right? Where are we? Yes, the Bacchanalian scandal in Rome. This Bacchus was sort of the god of wine and partying and all of that, and they started having some horrible things that they were doing in secret. All right? And after they were expelled, Rome made a rule that no meeting, nothing to do with religious purposes in secret. All right? We don't want any of this going on. Well, the Christians did meet in secret. And not only that, when they would observe what we call communion, the Lord's Supper, it was only members who were allowed to be there. That was their practice. Maybe it was whatever, but that's what they did. Also, baptisms tended to be a little bit more secretive. Again, it sort of fed itself because people were kind of targeting them anyhow. Then they were in secret, then they really targeted them. Okay? So that led to a number of things, and one of them being a lot of vicious comments being made about Christians. Ugly stuff, like covering a baby in flour and then turning out the light and stabbing it and eating a baby or that type of thing. Gross things. Cannibalism, it had to do with the text from John about Jesus saying, eating my flesh and so on like that. These were misinterpreted for sure, but they didn't have good ways of communicating either. So that was one of the great things that led to misunderstandings. And what would happen is that local people would rise up and say, we're not sure about them, and then they would try to kick them out, or Paul, and just like Paul was kicked out from one city to another, they didn't really send somebody after him, and sometimes the Roman officials would actually protect him, and other times they beat him up, they would flog him because they thought they were just troublemakers, and he's a Roman citizen, and then maybe they would put him in prison somewhere else, and he ended up traditionally at least being beheaded. So they were persecuted, but not unilaterally across the board. And so Christians actually liked the empire. They found security and protection, and they spoke well of things of the empire. For example, Irenaeus said, "We walk the roads in peace. We can safely walk." He's in Lyons, what's in today Lyons, France, but he came from what's modern Turkey, so that's a long journey. This just shows people traveled, and then he went to Rome and things like that. They could travel around, and they could do this in relative peace and safety. They appreciated that. All right, so they didn't even, and it was not a police state, so they weren't sending out secret police or trying to target these things. So it kind of depended on neighbors, on maintaining a good reputation, and then if you got somebody irritated at you, Tertullian tells a story about a woman who's, and Justin Martyr does too, actually, about people who had marital problems, the husband, for example, would bring a lawsuit against his wife for being this weird Eastern sect that she was wanting to go off to have services with, and what do they do there? And he doesn't know, but they don't want him to be there. And so some of these things, there's some interesting stories that come from. But there were some, then there were laws passed that there would, where Christianity was actually declared to be illegal. Yes?
How were the roads kept safe from the thieves and stuff?
Huh. That's a good question, and it wasn't completely. Like, by our standards, they were not whizzing down an interstate. So, taverns were a really bad thing. They were unsafe, a tavern being a place where you could get food and lodging, both. And it's one of the things that Christians created a chain of hospitality. They were expected to open their houses to others passing through, and it was actually a huge way that Christianity spread. So avoiding trouble was a big thing. Traveling with the bodyguard was another thing, was what people would do. Secondly, if a problem got too bad, then they would bring the Roman soldiers to clean it out. And I will give, I know what else I wanted to say about in the classroom, on the law of unintended consequences. So studying Roman history teaches that, and they honored their commitments to their allies, they tried to, but then they weren't always very nice to them either. Rhodes was an island that was a great maritime economic center, and they allied with Rome in the fight against the Seleucids, which were the Syrians, all right? Well, so they kept their status and all of that. But instead of, now they're a little bit jealous of all this money that's going through Rhodes and not into Rhodes is an island, I'm not talking about the roads that you walk on, that's going into Rhodes and not into Rome, they opened up Delos in the Greek islands as a free city where they would become a port. And what happened, so much money and commerce was shifted over to Delos that Rhodes lost all the business it was getting, even though it was an ally. So it was kind of a slick way of not punishing them. They just gave them a little bit of competition, you know, free competition, capitalism. And Rhodes lost it. Well, it had maintained a navy that kept the area free of pirates. When it collapsed, pirates came in like a, they were, there was a terrible problem. So this is an example Pompey the Great was commissioned to clean the Mediterranean Sea of all pirates, and he did a fairly fantastic job of it. It was awful, but those they got killed. And so if bandits got to be too big a problem, the soldiers would come and they would kill them all. And so that was what he was like, whatever you do, don't get too bad, because big problems come. And Herod the Great was responsible for the same thing, maintaining order. And this is another thing that they would do. They would have all these client states around, and as long as they swore allegiance to Rome, friendship, and would fight with Rome rather than against them, if they kept the peace, they were good to go. So that was Herod's position. He was not a Roman. He was appointed king by the Romans. And as long as he kept order, which he did with vicious control, then Herod is wonderful. Augustus joked he would rather have Herod's pig than his friend, because out of Jewish scrupulosity he wouldn't kill pigs. But friends were not so were not so protected. So that's an issue. Okay, I wanted to say that about the persecution thing. It was up and down. Sometimes the Roman law would protect Christians, other times it didn't. But it gradually shifted to where the great persecution came, and then it was an immense sweep, and it was a big problem. And then Constantine came along, and that was the end of that. It's a huge thing. The thing that I study in my own academic world is why did the bishops accept Constantine's involvement? You have any brilliant insights on it, I'm glad to discuss it with you. But that's my question. I don't blame Constantine for what Christians became. He was just a ruler, and a fairly effective one. Yes?
Did they have a choice?
Yes, they had a choice, because they had a choice under Diocletian whether to accept his orders or not. And they chose not to. And they were persecuted for it. And so there were Christian groups that also were deemed heretical, and they, by our standards, they were heretical, who also didn't accept Constantine.
By the way, I see the Bible. When Paul says, there's a riot wrath of me, there will be whoops in ship's clothes
yes.
coming.
Yeah.
That was fulfilled even before the end of the first century. So I don't give names, you know, I respect
yeah.
them in history. But those whoops, actually what did, they somehow eroded through their doctrines and philosophies the pure doctrine of the Christianity. And no wonder that this erosion firstly affected the top leaders who were permeated. So they were somehow corrupted by false doctrine in the middle.
Yeah.
250 years maybe?
So
years.
That's a great study of doctrine, of coming, and again, thousands of pages and many hours could be talked about the historical progression of that. I want to talk about what it was like to be a slave, because this what has happened so often, people read the New Testament and they say, oh, well, Paul didn't condemn slavery, so it must not be all that bad. I'm going to make one comment about that right off the bat. People who defend slavery are always do it from the perspective of the slaveholder, not the slave. Okay. If Mexico made a law saying it was legal for any American, any person who owned an American passport, that they could be kidnapped and legally taken into Mexico and sold as a slave, and that would be legal, we would not think that was a great thing at all. And it doesn't matter what Paul said. Okay? We wouldn't like it. Okay? So let's practice the golden rule on this a little bit. We don't like slavery if we're the slave. Okay? Having got that, I'll say another thing about it, and that is this. Slavery in the Roman period was not racially based at all. Anybody could become a slave. And the way it was, typically, debt slavery was going out of fashion. They didn't like that. But people who fought against Rome, what if they were conquered? If they weren't any good, they were killed. And if they were worth something, their bodies were worth something for anything. Then they were considered worth something, and they would be sold. Some of them would be bought by the state. They would be sent to the mines. They would be worked in unbelievable conditions, and there they would die. Okay? And they had thousands and thousands of them. So that was the idea. You send them off, you work them to death, and good riddance when they're gone. They are not going to fight against Rome anymore. All right? Secondly, others would be bought, and they would be taken in as a family. Now, if these slaves worked hard, and they were faithful, and they accepted my lot in life, that this is my bad,
This is what's happened to me. Now I will try to make the best of it. And if they could be rewarded for their diligent service, and many slave owners would free their slaves upon their death, or for outstanding behavior, they would offer freedom. Now, when they were given freedom, they became a Roman citizen automatically. And there are reasons for that in the histories. Read it. Okay, they are now a citizen, but they are not a normal citizen right off the bat. They did this. Remember these classes that they had? Up from the slave was the freedman status. A freedman was still not free to go and do whatever you felt like jolly well doing. You were legally a person. Your children could not be killed unless you wanted them to be. You had the right to determine whether you're a person or not upon birth. Remember that within 8 days you had to the father had to decide. Women were actually somewhat protected as well, and so on like that. But you were still under the protection and control of the patron. If your job was to be a clerk at a store, you kept being a clerk at a store, and you did well if you could. All right, and so you were legally protected. You could not be crucified. When Jesus said, "Take up your cross and follow me," he's talking about the death of a slave or a traitor. Right? He may have been talking about his own death, but that's not what his listeners would have thought of because he hadn't happened yet. Okay. When Spartacus revolted, for example, they lined the Via Appia with miles of crucified slaves. It was awful. These slaves could gain freedom. It was very normal to gain freedom. And then once they did, there was no racial bias held over top of them whatsoever. Even the fact they had bad luck is kind of what the word the Romans would use. And with good luck, their lot will improve. And with bad luck, they'll die. They're out. What Rome said was this: if you revolt against us, you are going to be absolutely destroyed, or you will become one of us. That's it. Your identity as a Gaul is gone. You're either going to die or you're going to become a Roman. One of the two. You resist, we'll kill you. Work with us, cooperate, love your life. Eventually you'll be rewarded Roman citizenship and you'll be allowed to buy a slave and make them a Roman or that type of thing. So there was this kind of class movement. And again, the children of freedmen were free and they could advance a step further. All right, than their parents. And they could then advance a step further than that. So Paul speaks very strongly of racism, and slavery and racism in the New World cannot be separated. Just get that, okay? Paul hated racism, and according to him, God does too. We should too, right? Let's be clear about that. So the racial institution of North America and the racial institute, the slave institution, were not at all similar in that sense. Furthermore, there was an idea in the beginning of the American Empire, if you want to put it that way, that they're going to copy this. For example, George Washington said, "I'm going to be like Cincinnaticus." That's where we get our Cincinnati. He was a Roman leader. At his death, George Washington freed all his slaves, right? But the racial problem crept in through because of the delineation that these are the only people who are slaves, or the ones that are more or less Africans. Yes?
Why does not the Bible speak against slavery?
So, I'm going to talk just a little bit about that.
In some passages.
That's what I'm talking about. So, Paul was saying this. Similar to what the Romans said, listen, some things cannot be easily changed. Remember, there's somebody above your master who is going to reward you as a person, whether you're admitted as a person or not. I'll give you one example of the way that the church dealt with it. It was an obvious problem. I'm talking to adults here, so be aware of this. It was an obvious problem that Roman masters would take sexual advantage of their slave women. All right, this is something that's happened through the ages. How does the church work with something like that? Well, they said it this way. If there is a slave, she will be called a concubine or considered a wife of her master if that is what the situation that she's in. And as long as she is faithful to only that, she's not living in promiscuous sin or something like that, she is accepted in our communion. Right? It was a solution. They couldn't change the master. And here is another lesson, and this comes right from Jesus with the Roman problem and so on. The cost
of violently revolting against it was going to be greater than what they would gain. But through all of this, Paul is teaching compassion. He's saying also, slave owners, don't forget you are also a slave. You're also going to give an account. There's a great Negro spiritual that goes, he's writing all the time. My Lord, he's writing all the time. All you do, all you say.
No Christian slave was encouraged by the doctrine to fight slavery, but rather to be a Christian is in his own status, right?
I'm not sure I understand what you said.
So the doctrine of the early church didn't encourage any Christian slave to get rid of slavery.
So,
but rather to behave as a Christian, being a slave.
Yes, with the idea that good behavior will often result in freedom. So Paul said, for example, he said, if you are a slave, be a good slave. Mm-hmm. If you are freed, allow yourself to be freed. If you are freed, do not seek to become a slave. In other words, it's going one direction. This should go in the direction of liberation, not in the other direction. Now, unfortunately, as Christianity became more institutionalized, and this is before Constantine, it became more socially acceptable and more rigid, and slavery became sort of accepted to be part of the situation. Okay? And so it can't, and for example, there's a council which says that if a woman beats a slave woman, I'm assuming it would include a man as well, if he beats her so bad that she dies, well, then she'd better not have communion for a while. And when I say a while, I mean actually quite a while, a couple of years. But otherwise, she probably deserved it, is kind of the concept. All right, so that is a showing of how they were assimilating those mores. I'll give you an example of the beginning of American slavery. And the very beginning, when they were bringing these slaves to Virginia, it was illegal to hold a slave for life if that slave was a Christian. You know that? Mm-hmm. If they were baptized Christians, it was illegal to hold them in lifetime slavery. Well, that got repealed eventually. But that was their beginning. So it was just kind of a step, servanthood to it. So, maybe that'll help a little bit. I wanted to say one thing yet, if you've got time for it. This is a neat little comment that not very many people know, and I've alluded to it just a little bit. Paul is a Roman citizen. How do you get it? It's puzzled a lot of people. He was freeborn. He was born to a Romanian. He was born to a Romanian. He was born to a Roman citizen. That's the only thing I mean. How did his father, who was a Jew, because Paul was a Jew and very proud of it, at one time at least, how did he become a Roman?
Some actually dare to say that he was not actually a Roman.
Some people dare to say, but he says he's freeborn, so we're going to assume that the biblical record is right.
Okay?
Does that mean his dad was a slave who was a good slave?
That is about the only logical explanation that somewhere Paul had an ancestor who was a Roman slave. Mm-hmm. Who then won the approval of his master and was eventually freed. In which case, Paul, I'll get to you. In which case, Paul, let's say it was his father. Let's say it was. And before, or his grandfather. And Paul is born. He would have needed permission to go to Jerusalem to study under Gamaliel. But he could have gotten it. That's all he needed. Like from his patron is saying, Lord, you know, can I go? May I be free from my obligation to you? And I will not call on you to protect me. That's how that system would have worked. There were two ways to that. And then he would have been free to kind of be his own person, but then he's adrift, you know. In all of this, there would have been a plaque that he would have had declaring the fact that he was, in fact, a Roman citizen. And he probably wore it around his neck. So you can believe the fact that when he was flogged there at Philippi, and he says, hey, we were actually citizens, these guys don't just take anybody's word for it that, you know, I don't want a flogging, so all of a sudden I'm a Roman citizen, okay? No, you've got to have proof. And so there were these plaques that they could have that would do that.
He needed the proof.
Yeah. So, that if you read it through that lens, all of a sudden reading what Paul is saying about slavery is starting to sort of make sense. But one thing he does say is never use the law as an excuse to abuse other people. Right? And slavery is an abuse. We understand that, whether without holding condemnation over top of those other people. So I really get a little bit irritated, people, when we use the New Testament to defend something like African slavery. It's wrong. We shouldn't do it. Okay? You're dismissed.